This is Peter Hooper, interviewed at Bass HQ in Cambridge by Chris Alden Lee on the 4th of July 2009. Peter Hooper.
My name is Peter Hooper, Peter R. Hooper. I was born in Edinburgh by chance. My family were actually living in Canada at the time, and they were just visiting Edinburgh, where my mother came from, in 29th of January 1931, I think.
So are you British, Scottish or Canadian?
I'm British, Canadian and American. How's that? I have passport for all three.
What were you doing before the Antarctic Hove interview?
I went to St Andrews University. I got a degree, first class in geology. And then I started a year's research, well, I started a three-year research PhD in this Scottish Hebrides. Only to be told after a year that Professor Wager at Oxford regarded the Scottish Hebrides as his and that no one else was allowed on, and my Harker grant was ceased forthwith. So I found myself, in spring of 54 or summer of 54, without a job and without many prospects, frankly, after 1 year's research. And wasn't sure at the time whether that was a convenient excuse by my supervisor for thinking I wasn't going to get very far and he might as well terminate me, or whether it was genuine, and I still don't absolutely know that. Anyway, I was there without a job. I then went off with a group from old friends from the university in an old London taxi and toured through Europe into Yugoslavia, which was the first year they'd opened up. It was called Belgrade or Bust, we had on our front, and we spent, I think, almost 2 months driving around there and got back. Got back to find I'd missed an interview at King's, where I should have probably got a demonstratorship. They were very kind to me and even had me go along and talk to them a bit, but they had given it to somebody else, so they really couldn't do much about it. And so there I was without a job, and then one of my friends, who was also looking for a job at the same time, noticed a advertisement for a geologist needed in the Falkland Islands Dependency Survey. Well, I had no idea what the Falkland Islands Dependency Survey was.
But you, being Scottish, you knew it wasn't off the Hebrides.
I knew, like Bob, it wasn't off the Hebrides. I had a vague idea it might be one of those groups of islands in the southwest Pacific that we had so many of in the past, and sort of rather vaguely. So I applied for this, any job.
You applied without looking at a map?
Indeed. Fortunately, before I went down for an interview, I had discovered that the Falkland Island dependencies were, in fact, part of the Antarctic Peninsula, etc. I did discover before I went to the interview. And so I went down and was interviewed. I was the only candidate. I knew that because when I sat outside the interview room, Johnny Green, who was the assistant secretary, rushed by, always late. Johnny Green was always late. Rushed by, didn't quite close the door properly behind him. And I heard him say as he approached the other two sitting at the desk, "Well, this is the only guy we've got. I guess we've got to take him." So that was good. And so I went in and we had a brief interview. There wasn't much to be said.
What do you remember of that? Because I guess therefore it wasn't too rigorous.
No, I can't remember. I mean, none of them were geologists for a start. And they knew my history and degree and things. So it was, I think, quite brief. More importantly, I then went along to see Vivian Fuchs at his desk, and he had a large chunk of malachite from Anvers Island. And this had been known for some time, and he'd recently got a chunk from somebody in the Falkland Islands who picked it up. And that's just opposite from Green Peak, just opposite Port La Croix. And he said, "Right, we want someone to go and find out whether there's anything significant. Malachite, of course, is copper ore. Is there anything significant? There's this great big green stain on what they call Green Peak, in fact, on the island. And we want you to go down and look around." Well, I had a degree in geology, it's true, but it was entirely igneous geology. And I'd never had a course or even a lesson in economic geology. I knew nothing about economic geology, nor did anyone else in my department, for that matter. But that was never even brought up. You know, that was never questioned. Fuchs never asked me whether I knew anything about economic geology. At least I can't remember him doing so. And anyway, that was it. So I was then told I had all the usual bits and pieces of medicals and teeth looked at and whatever, and this must have been quite late in September, I think, and told to report at Southampton on the 4th of October, and I would sail south.
The notion that there might be copper on Ambers Island was a bit thin, wasn't it? The evidence
it was thin. Fuchs mentions it in his book somewhere, I think, and points out that it was... Fuchs was looking for excuses to set up bases for scientific survey, basically, of any sort. And he was setting up, Horseshoe Bay went up the same year, and they came down together, in fact, the two groups, basically, in the following March, to set up those two bases. And so Fuchs was just looking for an excuse, I think. This seemed a pretty good one, so there I was, sent to Andrews Island to look for copper without the foggiest idea what I was supposed to be really looking for in terms of economic geology and the signs of hydrothermal systems and such like, which are what copper ore occurs in. I was an igneous petrologist. My interest was, you know, what was there and how did they get there? I was sort of slightly more fundamental, if you like, than the economic interest, because that's how I've been taught. So that was my past, and off I went.
Yeah, all right. How much did you actually know about the Antarctic at that point? Had you read the classic books? Had you researched it?
Nope. I mean, I knew of Scott and Shackleton, and always, I'm sorry to say, from the Polar Institute just round the corner, that I always thought Shackleton was worth 20 Scots. But that's an argument that's got to go on until time ends, I think. But Shackleton was a down-to-earth guy, my kind of guy. Scott was the establishment, too prone to sticking to what he thought should be as opposed to what actually was, and made, I think, awfully silly mistakes because of that. But Shackleton didn't. I mean, remember, just before Scott, Shackleton had turned back within relatively few miles of the pole and saved him, not only himself, but saved his men. Scott did not. And that's the difference between them, I think.
So you had a glimmer of this kind of British history in your eye?
Yes. I mean, I've been at good school and I've been to university, and I was reasonably, I hope, intelligent, if not. And yes, I had an idea of the past, but without any detail at all, of any great extent.
How did you prepare yourself? I mean, you had to gather equipment together, presumably.
No. We had no equipment. We weren't given any equipment. I wasn't even given a geological hammer, I don't think. I did discuss with Fuchs what was needed down there, because they're supposed to supply everything. I must have had a pair of spare clothes, but not much more. I had nothing to my name. I'd been a student on nothing for 4 or 5 years anyway, and I had a 2.2 rifle and a gown and a bicycle, I think, and I sold all those in Andrews, and that was my total sum. Was fortunately enough to get me down to London and probably to Southampton. I had a brother living in London, and that was it. So I didn't have a penny to my name. I didn't have any equipment. We were supposed to get equipment. I discussed with Fuchs, and that had created some problems later, because I said I'd need a microscope. Again, I was brought up as an igneous petrologist. You see, I'm used to looking at thin sections under the microscope. And section making equipment, etc., which is, you know, fairly bulky sort of stuff, and not just a hammer and a sack. And Fuchs said, yes, that'll be fine. We'll make sure you get that. Of course, I got down to Hope Bay and Anvers, where I spent the first summer at Hope Bay, and no sign of any of this stuff. And fortunately, the governor came in, and I did say to the governor, who I'd been skiing with, he was a very nice, Arthur was the governor, he'd been around and we'd been up skiing. He was an Olympic skier, I think, or potential Olympic skier.
So the Governor of Falkland Islands.
The Governor of Falkland Islands.
His name again was?
Governor Arthur. I forget his first name now. Mm. But Port Arthur, where Anvers was finally built, was named after him. He came down with us. And I did say that, point out that, you know, this had been promised and hadn't turned up. And, you know, it wasn't a good thing to be sent down without the adequate equipment. In fact, I hardly ever used the microscope. It wasn't a great...
You did get them, did you?
I did get them. They came down. By the time the Andrews ship came down in March, everything was there. So the governor made it work. The governor was like that, actually. He was a man who made things work.
Mm. Just back track slightly. Tell me what you made of Johnny Green.
Johnny Green?
Yeah.
A bit of a scatterbrain, I think. Not an ideal sect, Fids, I suspect. I slightly quarrelled with them as I came out, having had a very good relationship with them the first year. I got frustrated, but it was largely my fault. I don't blame Johnny Green for that, but I think he might have dealt with it a little bit better. He must have known that people get a bit sort of difficult at the end of 2.5 years, because they were long 2.5 years, and I was a bit frustrated. And
what were you frustrated by, Peter?
Well, desperately, we'd mapped most of the island, both topographically and geologically. But there was the northeast corner, which was very mountainous. It was obviously a different set of recent volcanics. We didn't know how recent. We had just got to the edge of them and got samples, but that was all we had. And we wanted to get in there. One of the reasons we climbed Mount Francis 3 times, in fact, eventually, to try and get up there so it looked down on the northeast corner and get some photographs and get some idea where we might get in. But that hadn't succeeded. We had finally got our photographs, but there seemed to be absolutely no way in. These were just sort of straight cliffs with nothing, no way up at all. And but we thought perhaps we could land on them by helicopter. And we had mentioned this to Johnny Green, and Johnny Green had been extremely helpful, as he was all the way down the road till the last minute. And he'd arranged for us to be picked up by the Royal Navy ship, I forget which it was at that point, but it had a helicopter in its back. So we went around to the north end of the island, the Melchior Islands, just off the north end of Anvers, and waited around there for a bit and found a decent day and went up. I went up with the pilots and looked at one of these ridges, and he dropped something down, and the snow was obviously so deep and so soft, and very narrow ridges when you got up there. He said, there's absolutely no way we can land there. This isn't going to work. So we had to accept that, and that was that. We tried, and Johnny Green had gone to a lot of trouble to help us. Unfortunately, just at that point, the ship was called away in some emergency to Australia to meet up with some factory ship. I don't know whether the factory ship had been doing something wrong or they had to go and check in it, but they whipped off without dropping us back on Anvers, or even Port La Croix, or we could have got back home, took us right away out to this great messy whale ship, then went back and dropped us off at Deception. And this was certainly February, if not March already. And there was only one more boat going home. And I had all my samples from 2.5 years and all my notes to write up and get things ordered before I left the base.
They were at Anvers.
They were at Anvers. Here's me stuck in Deception with no obvious means of getting down there at all. And the last boat going home any minute now. So I was a bit frustrated. And fortunately, the Olof Sven with the Fadasi group came into Deception. And Jim Rennie, I think, was with them. Or he might have been dropped off in King George Island, but then I don't know. But he was with that group at that stage. And what's his name, the guy running Fadasi? I'm sorry, the name, as names do escape me these days. He's written a book. He was very kind and said, well, I think we're going down that way. We can get you at least to Port La Croix, which would have been perfectly adequate. In fact, he took us all the way back to Anvers. So fortunately, I had about a week, 10 days to get myself sorted and get things organised and finally catch the last, I think it was the Shackleton that took us back, the last boat out. So I got it. In the meantime, one of my members, Dennis Kershaw, I had sort of handed over the base. Again, I was getting a bit above myself, I think it's fair to say, at this stage. I couldn't be bothered with... We'd never been much bothered with the organisation in Stanley. We had very little communication with them. But I had basically arranged to transfer the leadership, I was base leader, to John Thompson. He was my deputy and he was the obvious person to take over, and I just sort of transferred and said, okay, you take over now and I'll tell Johnny Green. Well, that's not the way Johnny Green liked to do it. Johnny Green was the guy who made these decisions, not me in the base. And it was a bit arrogant and not very tactful. I mean, I'm sure Johnny Green would have taken my advice and made John Thompson, but that wasn't quite the point. Okay. I just assumed that John would take over and told Johnny Green, not asked him. So I think John had some reason to be a little pissed off with
you
me, frankly.
You weren't doing things to the Queensbury rules?
I wasn't doing things to the Queensbury rules. I was frustrated. I was a bit angry. I was just generally end of my tether, frankly, looking back at it. And I have a lovely photograph, actually, of my sitting on the boat as it goes out, looking very depressed. But this guy, Dennis Kershaw, when I was away on this trip to the north, had simply agreed with John Thompson to take one of our little boats around to Port Lockroy, which we'd done before a number of times, and it wasn't new. And this was midsummer, after all, which we'd done it in winter as well as summer when we shouldn't have done. And that was no big deal. But then he'd gone on from Port Lockroy right round to the north, which was the base to the north of the recent base, north of Lockroy, where he was going next year, and spent some time with them. And then when one of the boats came through with John Brown as the captain, he'd been first mate when I went down, he was another very arrogant man, a very foolish man, I think, for the record. But he was first mate then and was now captain of this new Shackleton or Biscoe, whatever it was. And when Dennis Kershaw, who was a Lancashire guy and very outspoken and said what he thought and didn't sort of, wasn't always very tactful, and came alongside and said, would you please take me back to Anvers? That's where I want to get back to Anvers, pick up my stuff. And John Brown was very cross. He said, you know, he didn't think Dennis should be there. He shouldn't be playing around in boats, little boats. And of course, the captains of those ships are the bosses at this sort of stage, above any base leader or anyone else. They're the boss. And so he wrote a very angry note to, he refused to take Dennis on board, and wrote a very angry note to John Green saying, you know, this should be stopped. These people shouldn't be fooling around in little boats. We've been doing it for 2.5 years, and most of our work was done that way, frankly. So Johnny Green had then said, oh, okay. So he sent out a sort of memo to everybody. No more little boating, more than, I don't know what this thing said, but probably no more than half a mile from base or something, you know. And I got note of this just as I was getting back to Anvers, I think, and thought that was very silly. Again, I was not in the best of moods, and I basically wrote a little note to Johnny Green saying I thought this was a bit stupid. I can't remember what I wrote. I'm sure I wasn't quite as tactless as that, but I was certainly criticising his decision. And again, John didn't like that, as you may well imagine, and obviously concluded that I was getting a little much too big for my boots. And that was that. So John and I didn't get on too well as we left. No, nothing ever came up. It was sad in a sense because we had such a great first year, and John came down and with lots of others, we were obviously the heroes of the year, so to speak, and done so well. We'd done a lot of work. We'd been out almost all year without being at base, and got a lot of work done. And John was obviously very pleased, and as was Fuchs and other people. And it was sad, therefore, to after 2.5 years that the thing ended sadly, insofar as that we didn't see eye to eye. But it was mainly my fault, I think. I was.
Let's backtrack then.
Okay,
that was
sure.
About the end of your experience.
That was the end of the experience. That's right.
But we also flash back to the beginning of your experiences, and I think we have you heading off. First of all, was it first to Anvers, or did you go somewhere else?
No, we went, I was on the, one of the things about FID in those days was complete lack of communication. You had London trying to run things, you had Stanley trying to run things, and then you had people on the bases trying to run things, and they seldom met up properly and agreed. I got, having basically gone down to go to Anvers, as far as Fuchs was concerned, I got to Stanley, and given this miserable equipment we were given, which was old ex-army stuff, which was completely inappropriate, and then sent on down to on board the boat, only to learn when I got to Hope Bay that a Hope Bay party of four, including a geologist who was leaving that year, had been designated to go and look at Anvers for a possible base site. And, of course, this had been arranged by Hope Bay, so I was unknown and wasn't involved. And I did sort of rein this. I went down with Bill Anderson, who was the new coming in bass leader and bass bass leader, in fact, Fids leader, and pointed out that, you know, I was meant to be coming to Anderson. I wasn't involved in this. So Bill, who had just arrived as the new bass leader, couldn't very well change the arrangements they'd made, but did let me go on down in the boat as a sort of replacement should anyone fall out. So I went on down, but they weren't really interested in getting on Numbers Island. All but one of them were leaving anyway, I think, that year. And they made one from Port Lockroy. They made one brief attempt to go around the south coast and, into Biscobay, and said no, they couldn't see anything interesting, so came back. And we were going to try on the way out, but we got stuck in the ice off the Argentine Islands. And so it took us a week or two longer than we expected down there. And then on the way back, Bill Johnson, the captain of the Biscoe, said, no, you know, we've got to get back. Mm-hmm. So he went out around the outside of Anvers, and no other attempt was made. But that was the sort of indication of the sort of lack of communication between these three areas of control there.
Was that because the communications weren't there, or because they weren't listening to each other?
Well, I think they didn't want to know from the other side. I mean,
London was a far-off country.
London was a far-off country. Stanley had no particular interest in the geology of Anvers Island. Fuchs had, but what was the game? What was the sex Fids who was, wasn't Johnny Green, who was still in London at that stage? This was, I forget his name now, but the sex Fids was in Stanley. And then there was the base leader in Hope Bay. And, you know, I imagine Stanley had told Hope Bay, you know, get a party out and see if you can find a place on Namas Island to build a hut. And so he'd done so. But it didn't involve me. My name was never involved. And that's lack of communication, probably, I suppose, because I suppose folks might have mentioned that I was coming down, but obviously never did. And he had other things in his mind, to be fair. He was preparing his transatlantic trip. So that was that. So I went back to Hope Bay and stayed off in Hope Bay for the summer, which was very nice. I enjoyed Hope Bay and did a little bit of geology around there. It had all been pretty well done around the base. There wasn't much to do. I just enjoyed myself, really. A little bit of boating, and I went out on two short sledge trips with Joe Lewis and Alan Precious, which was very useful with dogs. So when we went to Anvers, eventually, I was the only person with any knowledge of, A, the normal Fids processes, how the bases work, basically, and driving sledges and dogs. So I stayed there until early March when the Norsel came down from London with the Anvers group and the Horseshoe Bay group and picked me up. And I was told I was going to be base leader.
At Anvers?
Before I left Hope Bay. I think I put that down to my discussions with the governor originally, I think. I think I obviously made some sort of impact on
so
him.
So it sounds like you were surprised to learn you were going to be base leader.
Yes, I had no suspicion I'd be base leader, no. I might easily have stayed at Hope Bay because they had a big sledging program, and I would have been quite happy to participate in that as the geologist going down the East Coast, and that would have been fun as well. But I had to make a decision. I think the decision was mine, but I can't be absolutely sure of that now. I think the decision was mine, and I just said, no, I'll go to Anvers, and I was made base leader. Yeah.
So when you got to Anvers, to the location for the base, what was there? Nothing?
Nothing at all. I think this was quite well written up in Fuchs's book, actually, because Ken, what was his name? Oh dear, names I'm sorry, just got in my head. But Ken, who was in charge of the Norsel going south for setting up both these bases, went round and we drove into what's now called Arthur Harbour, in a nice little cut off bay with an excellent place for bare rock for building a hut on. And it looked like a pretty good slope up behind. And in fact, Ken and the governor and I, the governor was with us again, went up the slope and saw that it was a clear way up onto the plateau so we could get around the island from the base. And that was that. And we managed to persuade the governor to keep the ships there longer than they were meant to be there to help us do the first hard work in building that, you know, all the cementing in the bottom and doing that part. So we got away to a very good start, both from the Norsel and the Biscoe, think the governor was on the Bisco, actually came in later. But it was excellent, and so we got a good start, and we had the whole hut built within a month. And living in it, yes. Yeah.
So priority number one was to get some walls and roof out, was it?
Absolutely, and to get ourselves inside. Yes, we were living in a sort of bit of canvas sitting on top of packing boxes most of that month. So we were very glad to get inside.
Did you have any design input?
No, none at all. No, everything was packaged. The whole hut was packaged. We had a very good, very versatile carpenter, Arthur Shorey, who had been in the army since he was 16, you know, and just come out. He was the elder statesman in our group. He was at least 3 years older than the rest of us. And there were bits missing, of course, in these packages. There always are, you know, too few nails or too many nails or something, and quite critical bits were missing. We got some sent in from, perhaps they'd gone down to Horseshoe Bay, I don't know. But anyway, we got some bits back to finish off with. So we were all right.
Tell me, describe the base then. What was it like? You were a brand new base, first time ever.
Absolutely. So we called it Skua Lodge.
Walk me around it.
Well, you go in the normal door, the door that was nearest the shore and where we landed and met people. You walked into a little lobby. There was the bathroom, the loo, and it was a sort of tub for a bath on the right-hand side. Straight ahead was the sledge workshop where Arthur Shorey, incidentally, we had these dog hauling sledges, which were meant for dogs and were quite heavy. We had no dogs the first year. We had to man-haul, and these were very heavy to man-haul. And Arthur, and the skill still amazes me, took that sledge apart and split every timber in it in half.
To make it lighter
and put it together again. And two sledges, and they both lasted us for 2 years. It was remarkable.
Is that something he did off his own bat?
His own bat. We decided this was too heavy. You know, we needed to modify these.
You didn't have to refer that to...
No. We referred nothing. We had really no adequate wireless communication. We had John Canty with us, who had been in the Merchant Navy, and had some vague knowledge of Morse code. I wouldn't put it more than that. But the only transmitter we had was a peddling machine. We had nothing else. So you had to peddle and do your Morse at the same time. I know how difficult it was, because the second year, our operator was taken away from us and sent down to Horseshoe Bay, because theirs had come out rapidly. It was much more important, they had one than it was for us. So I had to do it. And my Morse code was virtually zero. Boy Scouts was as far as I'd ever got with that. And I know how difficult it was peddling and trying to do Morse code things. I had to do some things in code to Johnny Green, because they were confidential regarding the base, how things were going sometimes. And it was very difficult. So
was it akin to patting your stomach and rubbing your head?
Something like that, yes, and really quite difficult. And it was in the loft, and it got very hot up there, and the heat coming up from the rest of the house. But we had John Canty the first year. We had six the first year and only five the second, because our operator had been taken away. So anyway, where was I? Oh, and we went in the shop. The workshop was there. Then you turn right into the kitchen, which had a big Essie stove, very efficient, which we had to set up, of course. Had a big tank for putting ice into to make water, and a lot of storage cupboards, and a table and benches behind, and some chairs, and that was about it, I guess. And then we moved from into the far side end of that into the corridor that went along the far side of the hut and turned right into the living and bedroom, the major room of the house, where Arthur built a very nice little bar when we were away and caught out in Lockeroy. He built this beautiful little bar. We did have some beer and drink with us. And then the bunks were around the two levels on two sides, and that was our main and a big stove, a stove for burning. We had a lot of coal, so we could burn a lot of, we could make a big fug in there if we wanted to. And then further down the corridor, there was a printing room,
developing
photographic room,
dark room.
Yeah. Sorry. And then on the right was my little office, which was used for the survey and for the geological survey, and as my base leader office, where we had the post office, basically, because not only was I base leader, I was also postmaster general. And
was there much call for that in the 1950s?
Well, there was no other communication. I mean, we had no emails, no wireless. We occasionally got a radio. They had a system where they every so often they once a month was it. There was a little program for FIDS that came out from London, and different people came on to speak. Family members came to speak to Hillary. Someone was running that. I forget who it was. Somebody who became quite well known later, but he ran that. My fiancée wasn't really my fiancée, my girlfriend, because my father had gone back to Canada, so she was the nearest I had. And she came on once or twice, to great amusement of all my friends.
So the radio program could only be heard in the Antarctic? Or could it be heard everywhere?
I don't know that.
From
I can't.
World Service, I presume.
It must have been. It must have gone out. I imagine it was a fairly special line. I don't imagine. But I don't know.
And the post office, so you were just dealing with letters from the six of you on...
Yes, we wrote letters and sent them out, and sometimes other people dropped letters off for us to post. Not the tourist boat was ever heard of in those days. No. It wouldn't have been allowed.
Was it a picturesque setting? I mean, was it particularly spectacular?
That part of the Antarctic is probably, I think, probably the prettiest part of the whole of Antarctica. It is extremely... Port La Croix onto Anvers, and just north and just south. Is perhaps the Gerlache Straits and forget the straits just to the south, they got a name, are quite dramatic. Mount Francis on Anvers is the highest island north of the circle, highest mountain north of the circle, in Antarctica. So it is spectacular, ice and rock and blue sea and blue sky and lots of animals, birds and beasts of various sorts. So it is very spectacular. I think I still think it's probably the most spectacular. That's why everyone goes to Port La Croix in these tourist ships. It is the most spectacular spot. You don't really need to go further to see spectacular Antarctica.
As you embarked on your 2 years at Anvers Island, what were your feelings? Were you nervous, concerned?
I wasn't nervous at all. Never been of a nervous disposition, I don't think. But I was... mixed feelings. I had just decided that I wanted to get married, and discussed this with my future wife, and we're talking about days before I left now, and we decided yes, that was probably quite a good thing to do, but clearly we didn't want to tie each other down over 2 years, so nothing was official. And she was still at St Andrews, actually. I had another year there before coming down to work in London. And I, of course, had 2 years away. So, but it was a great joke on the ship going down, because I don't know how it came out, but something came out. And it became known that Caroline was my girlfriend, and lots of fun and games were had around that, which was fine. And she sent music things and that, I think, on the ship before we got to our bases. And she had organised music records and things to be played, and as had others, of course. But this was my component. So I had, you know, leaving one's potential fiancé for 2 years seemed a bit bizarre, to put it mildly. But it became more bizarre as time went on. In a way, I realised, you know, just how, you know, what a extraordinary thing to do. Really, it was particularly difficult when after the first year, which had been very successful. We had great fun. People like Jim Rennie and others. And we'd done a lot of work and felt very pleased with ourselves and happy. Then they all left. Every one of them left except me. So I had a whole new crew the second year. And, of course, they all gung-ho and knew everything. And none of them had been down before, but that didn't... Well, actually, one had. One had been at Signy the year before, John Bull. But on the whole, you know, they were new and just like we had been the year before and knew it all. And I had to sort of try and compromise between being the old hand and telling them what to do and not sort of trampling on their enthusiasm. And we also had a much more difficult job the second year. We had to work along the coast, which was an almost impossible survey job. We were up and top and trying to look down And the coast was always in mist. Surveyors could never see what they were looking for at another point. And there was very little rock along there for me to work on. So it was a much more difficult and less fruitful, yeah.
Is it bad policy then to send a whole new team out? Would you have advised them against that? Or was it just the way it worked?
Well, everybody wanted to go ahead. First of all, it's just the way it worked. Yeah. I mean, everyone else in the base had signed on for a year. I had signed on for 2 years. That was as simple as that. I'm sure they wouldn't contemplate that sort of organisation now. I mean, as I say, it was a pretty sort of screwed up lot of people who were trying to make things work with very little money, I suspect, to play with. And every bit of money people like Fuchs had to scrounge for. So these things were just sort of part of the process, I guess.
So you embarked upon a 2-year quest to find copper on Ambers Island.
That's basically what it amounted to, yes.
And
yeah.
And how did you go about that?
Well, we had to go out and, first of all, find out where we could get. And we had numerous sledge trips, all man-hauling, I'm going to say. I don't know if you know who was the guy who worked in Greenland, the very well-known explorer in Greenland from Cambridge. Again, the name escapes me. Watkins, Gino Watkins. Made some remark about man-hauling as being the silliest and most perverse activity human beings ever undertook. And indeed, sometimes pulling a sledge when conditions weren't very good was pretty frustrating. It was hard work, very jolly good for us. We were very fit by the end of it. And we learned, you learned ways around, including making lighter sledges, working at night when it was colder in the summer and things like that. So we learned lots of tricks and became quite efficient at it. But we did get dogs the second year.
So did you find any copper?
There was lots of copper malachite staining, but we didn't find any copper. No, the answer was that copper was never found, never has been found. But there was, not so much where they'd seen the copper staining, which was opposite Portlaoise in a place called Green Peak, that around the base was, in fact, as it's turned out, a very large, what they would now call a hydrothermal area, which is the sort of thing that produces minerals, zinc and copper and all these sorts of things, with veins and alteration of the, with hot waters coming through and altering the rocks and depositing these elements, these minerals and metals, largely. Well, as I say, I was not an economic geologist, so I didn't recognize it. And I think perhaps that was so early in terms of economic geology was evolving very fast at that stage. I'm not sure that many others would have noticed it. Certainly when I got back and described all these rocks, and I did describe them as being very odd and metasomatized and different from what one might have expected. And Ray Eady, who was the geologist in charge at Birmingham, and my examiner for my PhD was Knuckles from Cambridge, who was a very well-known geologist. Neither of them, reading my thesis or reading my descriptions, came up and said, oh, this is a hydrothermal zone. So I'm not sure that I was all that off beam. But people did go in 10, 20, 30 years later and realized that it was a major hydrothermal area. And had therefore some economic potential. I don't think it's ever been materialized as it just remained potential. There's one nice report written by, in this case, the Argentines, the Chileans, and the Americans went in before the British went back. But the British report did say that it made some remark about it. It was quite remarkable that Britain had had a geologist sitting on top of this for 2 years. And the hydrothermal thing had not been recognized. Some such very, very mildly rebuke. and he was quite right, of course. But yes, that was. But I knew nothing about it. I was interested and I was fascinated by the evidence of metasomatism, because it isn't. I wasn't wrong in calling it metasomatism. It was a metasomatic effect with hot liquids coming through and altering the rocks. And slightly bizarre way in many ways, and it was quite intriguing. And we had a lot of these little islands around the base that we could look at in some detail, as opposed to the bits of rock and up in the main mountains and on the main island, which were much less accessible. We did a lot of, I was able to do quite a lot of quite detailed geology around the bases, in fact.
Looking back on it, was it important work?
The simple answer to that is no, I'm sorry to say, both topographically and geologically. I mean, it was important in the sense that we established on sort of larger maps what sort of rocks were where and how they fitted in basically with what was on the east coast and what was in Hope Bay in the north and further south. So it was important geologically in that very broad sense and had to be done. But in terms of understanding and what was done later by people who understood hydrothermal systems and went in and looked at it in some detail, ours was fairly superficial. I can say I at least drew their attention to something a little bit different there, but that's about as much as I can say. In terms of the topographic survey, and people like Jim Rennie, who did so much work, plane tabling and you know, using their, what's the names, point-to-point
triangulations,
so much work and worked so hard. Before he'd finished, they'd started the air survey, FIDASI, which he had later joined, but that put all the sort of groundwork, other than locating particular points for the air photos to pin themselves down on. Basically, all that detailed work was virtually useless. And then, of course, before that had finished, the satellites came in, and that became useless. So it was all done sort of almost by machine from the satellites. And so it's, in a sense, this is how things evolve. But that's how things go. So you can say, in a way, our science was of limited value, I think.
Short-term value.
Short-term value, yeah.
But isn't all science?
Well, that's right, it is.
Constantly being used as a new science.
Absolutely.
Yes.
It just seemed particularly obvious in that area.
at that time.
Well, I wasn't frustrated because I'd long gone before this became obvious. I was doing my own thing elsewhere and didn't have to worry about it. But
Tell me about some of the dangers you faced. I mean, everybody says health and safety. Never heard of it,
absolutely.
In those days. Did you have any moments where, if there had been a health and safety manual, you might have reached for it?
I doubt it. We would have topped it down the nearest crevasse if we'd probably had such a thing. Yes, there are dangers. It was a matter of common sense and a lot of luck. We worked on this island, which was covered largely in ice, which was full of crevasses, which they are very deep and very dangerous. I remember once, for example, skiing with our supposed mountaineer. Jim Rennie was the real mountaineer. He was a natural mountaineer. But we had someone who'd, quote, trained as a mountaineer and came down as a gash hand and mountaineer. And he was slightly sort of health and safety type approach because that's what he'd been taught. He'd had a course, a very short course, I think, but he'd had a course. And we were skiing down, trying to get down to the sea in this fairly long slope, which was crisscrossed with crevasses of various sorts and sizes. And none of us could ski adequately. We were all just beginning to find our feet, and the skis were extremely poor skis, I may say. We were given the most dismal equipment. This guy insisted we wore a rope, because that's what the book said. When you're on crevassed areas, you wear a rope. But if you imagine people who can't ski anyway, on one of the solid ice, which the skis couldn't even stand up, never mind move, and then have a rope tied to you as well, and with someone else tugging at you or pulling the other way, it was this simple chaos. And anyone could have been pulled into a crevasse just by being pulled by somebody else. So I had to jump in and say, sorry, but we can't use ropes here. This is ridiculous. So we took the ropes off, but I don't think he ever quite forgave me for overruling him in that sense. He had problems anyway, and he tended to stay in base for the rest of the year, basically. He was a good cook and was happy to stay in base, so that was very convenient.
Was there particularly a moment when you thought perhaps your time was up?
Many times.
Yeah, really?
Quite honestly, many times. We had problems with the boat. We had problems on land. We had one very, very big windstorm one night. Hope Bay, I think, maybe even lost somebody that night. But our tent was you know, if you lose your tent in those sort of conditions, and this was not midsummer, this was well into the year. This storm sort of flattened or broke two poles, I think, and we spent the night trying to hold the tent down. One of us went out and tried to put more snow on the sleeves, which is how you normally hold the tent down, but it just blew away. The tent began to tear, and we just hung on all night, basically, and we thought we were very lucky to get through it, because that tent had gone. We were finished. There was nothing to protect us at all. That was one particular case on land, but on boats, we did a lot of boating, and we shouldn't have done it in midwinter. Boating in midsummer is dangerous enough, and as I said earlier, you know, some people thought we shouldn't be using the boats at all. Never mind using them as working tools, because they're only little things with those terrible little outboard motors. What were they called? I forget what they're called, but they're the most bizarre outboards you ever. They were terribly light, and they were always breaking down. You know, the outboards you see now are so solid and dependable. These were not. They could break in almost anyway. And yes, Jim Rennie and I did a lot of boating. And I always think Jim saved my life probably half a dozen times by being a little cooler and having more common sense than I had. I was gung-ho and said, oh, let's get home.
You were the base station. You should have been ensuring the safety of your men at
all. I should have been, but I was. Our base was not one that needed a leader, if I can put it that way. We were a very democratic lot. We were a sensible lot, I think. When someone had a view, they gave it, and if it sounded on the whole more sensible. Jim was always very sensible. I relied a great deal on Jim. Yes, there was an occasion when we were landing at a depot along the shore, just a sort of day's boating trip from the base. But those adiabatic winds come, you know, suddenly the wind gets up and blows offshore from the ice off the sea, and they're very strong. We just landed with some difficulty in a rather rocky point where we probably shouldn't have tried to land. We'd got our stores ashore, the depot we needed to leave, and then just managed to push off with some difficulty with the waves very big. Then the engine faltered and wouldn't start. And I forget just the details now. It's written down somewhere, I think. But something came off and we were being pushed. This wind was taking us further and further from the shore, and we couldn't get the damn boat to... And the oars were useless because there was only one of us. One person was fiddling with the engine. The other was trying to steady with the oars. But the sea was very rough you know, one doesn't think you've got to get that engine to go again. You know, it's, I forget what happened, something fell off it. And we had to make some substitute or something. But we did eventually manage to get the engine to go again. And after a long fight against the wind, we managed to get back to where we'd started and spend the night there. I think we may have spent 2 nights there because I was quite anxious to get home to base the next day, because I was worried that the base would get worried that we hadn't come back. That was my main concern, and they might then contact Stanley and tell him that two men were lost or something. That was my main concern. But the sea was still rough, and I remember Jim Quince saying, no way, this is too rough, we shouldn't go. And he was right, and we didn't go. We went the next day and got back, and the base had... Oh, they'll get back. They hadn't been worried about us at all. So that was fine. And then there was the big occasion when we got over, and this was right over midwinter, and we'd gone over to Lockroy. They had picked us up in their boat and taken us over. They had one boat and an old boat that was sort of sunken under mud and things that had been abandoned. And we, after midwinter, we had tried to get back. And that's a long, long story. The fascinating thing that always fascinated me was Bob Whittick, Jim Rennie and I. This was the most dramatic adventure we had for all three of us, in a way. And our stories were so different. You can't imagine how different. To me, it was all sort of one day. In actual fact, it was 3 days. We have this because it's written in the official report, base report. And Jim and Bob's memories were much better than mine.
In a nutshell, what was the incident?
Well, the incident was we were trying to use their boat to get back around the south end of Andrews Island and back to our base, which was quite a long journey, even in the best of times. And this was midwinter. And the ice came in and the ice went out and the ice came in and the ice went out, the winds came up and the winds went down. It was foolhardy to be out. No normal base would be, with more sense, would be out running around in boats. Never mind, they wouldn't be running around at all in sledges, never mind boats.
And yet you had presumably approved this.
I had approved it. I had led it. I'd led the charge, I'm afraid. Yes, we were gung-ho. We all agreed it was a good thing to do, and let's try it. You know, at that age, it's just a question of let's try it.
Did the immortality thinking creep in?
More or less. We actually tried to get back. We got stuck in pack. Our engine failed. We got stuck on a neighbouring island to Port La Croix. We could see them, and they could see us, but we couldn't get across to them. At one stage, I can remember, we were stuck in the ice. The ice was too thin to walk on. It was too thick to push the boat through, even with oars. And I can remember, I think, well, the only thing to do is to go to sleep. And, you know, if you do that, you're probably not going to wake up. Mm-hmm. And I can remember, you know, quite consciously thinking, well, it's a shame. You know, lots of things I haven't done. I haven't got married. I haven't done any of these nice things I'd like to do sometime. But that's it. I wasn't curious that I wasn't frightened in any sense, I don't think. It was just slightly sad. It was what I remember. And of course, in the first incident, we were fighting to get the boat back onto land, things like that, against a big sea. Your adrenaline is flowing so fast you don't think of anything. You're just trying to get yourself going, trying to get the boat going. But this was an occasion where there was nothing we could do. We couldn't move the boat either way, and we were just there. And we have drifted back onto the other island and were able to get out there. But Bob will tell you some of that tale as well, I think. He's written it out, actually. He's written his part out. And, of course, he had an even more dramatic part of that, because having taken us back to eventually to our own island, he and Alan Carroll were on the way back, and that's where I told you about that incident, that Bob had got a bit irate with Alan, to put it mildly, which was just a build-up of many weeks and months of frustration in both their cases. He'll tell you this, I'm sure, I've probably told you this, and it's written up in the BAS bulletin newsletter, but they were, you know, unloading their boat, and the ground sheet blew away, and he tried to pick it up, and then he went out, and he dumped his engine already, so only had oars. And then it was dark and he was gone. You know, he'd been blown away from the land. Those adiabatic winds again take you away so quickly. And he went right round this big Doomer Island to the south of Loch Roy and came up on the far side and fortunately managed to travel back. But that was
the story this morning.
Yes, and that was a real epic, because Bob was not one of us. I mean, he wasn't one of the people who were, you know, going out sledging every day. They were in a static base. They weren't supposed to leave their base more than 10 feet or something ridiculous. And so he was not sort of fit and like we were, used to pulling sledges around all over the island. He was not fit. And I would have, if he'd asked me at that time, could anyone walk along? I don't know if I've ever seen a picture of the Sea Art of here. But it's a huge cliff. I don't know how many, 2,000 feet straight up pretty well. And down in just, you know, block of ice along the bottom. And with you know, huge sort of cuts into it. And I would have said it would be virtually impossible for anyone to walk along that. And Bob did it on his own and got back. And I think that was absolutely extraordinary. I do think it was extraordinary.
Looking back, do you think there was a rather too much foolhardiness?
Was there too much foolhardiness? That's a good question. I suppose the answer to that has to be yes. I think that's right. And certainly the second year, I'm sure I was much more circumspect. We had a duller job to do anyway. We still had some interesting little bits and pieces. But yes, I think we were more circumspect. I guess I felt slightly more responsible in the sense that everyone else was new and I was supposed to be the person who knew things. The first year we were all new and equally ignorant.
how were relations generally in the Antarctic? People, generally speaking, say that everybody gets on well with everybody else, but...
Well, I've told you, yes, I've told you about the problems in Port La Croix, where clearly there was a problem about leadership and the natural leader and the imposed leader, in a way. It's not that the imposed leader wasn't quite a strong character. He's had a very interesting later career, in fact, done a lot of very interesting things. So it wasn't that, it was just that at the time... he was in conflict with virtually everyone else on the base, and there was a natural leader there who had to sort of work around this and did, and they all survived. But at our own base, there's always somebody who's a little bit more awkward and difficult to fit in than the others. In both my 2 years there, there was one such person. The first time, this guy who was, as I said, trained as a mountaineer, went down. He hadn't said he had a bad back. He'd had done something to his back in his youth, and he hadn't told anyone about this, which he should have done. And so this cropped up. So he basically, after one or two manhauling was not the ideal thing for someone in that situation. And I think I'm right in saying it was him rather than the guy the second year who was somewhat frightened of crevasses. You know, crevasses are one of those things that some people just take for granted and deal with, and other people have a thing about it. They just can't take crevasses. So he tended to stay in base for most of the year after the first few, perhaps a couple of months, I don't know. He didn't mind that. He was quite a good cook, and we always had nice scones and cookies and things whenever we got back to base, which was very nice. The same thing happened the second year. I think it was the second year. I think it was the second year that I did recommend this guy go out. I don't know whether he's still around, actually. We haven't been able to contact him and find out what happened to him. But he did have, I think it was he who had a real fear of crevasses. And actually didn't want to go out when it came down to it. He, again, was an excellent cook, was happy to stay at home. And then we had dogs, so we had to have... We couldn't take all the dogs out on a trip. We had to leave some dogs behind, and then puppies, of course, as well. So we did need someone in base, and he did that job very well. But he was a... From my point of view as base leader... probably, I'm sure, not from his point of view, a difficult person, tended to quarrel with others. He was down, I think, for 2 years, and I did suggest to John Green that perhaps it would be wiser to take him out rather than leave him for a second year.
Did that happen?
It did happen, yes. It was the only time I did ever felt necessary to do that.
Difficult to answer this one, but do you think that was actually... underlyingly typical of every base, and that the story of the constant stories of peace and harmony are somewhat rosy-coloured spectacles?
Absolutely.
You think there was always tensions at every base?
Absolutely. I mean, I know at Hope Bay, where I spent that first summer, that there was a very old hand called Jock Tate, who had been down four or five times behind him. He had been a lighthouse keeper, he was as tough as nuts, and a great character, and knew it all. And then there was Bill Anderson, who was a major in the army or had been, and was made base leader, in fact, leader of the whole organization down on the bases, as boss. And I know when they went on their long trip, they had real problems, much like the ones at Lockroy, when people got, very, very upset and to the point where somebody might have come to grief. I know when Bill flew out. Bill was only there for a year, and came out. In fact, through Andrews. You know, for some reason, he was picked up in a helicopter at Andrews, I think, and taken off from the naval ship. Rather special treatment, but anyway. But he was a very chastened man when he went out. You know, Bill was a very gung-ho going down, you know, could he make really something of this, and which is great. And Jock Tate was his big mate. I got pictures in the bag here of him and Jock having fun together. But, you know, these tensions arise, and particularly when you're under pressure and things aren't going too well. But they never come out. You know, Bill's book, which you probably know about, I don't think there's any discussion of that or I mention that at all. Perhaps there couldn't be, I don't know.
And is rank or discussion about rank a key factor usually? That's, there's some debate about who, there's some internal debate about who actually should be in charge.
Well, I think...
Who gives orders to who?
To me there was, and should be. My complaint about the FIDS organisation, and particularly people like Johnny Green and his, and the, he was assistant secretary, I forget the name of the guy who was secretary at the time, but their concept was that, you know, it was British class, really. Mm. You know, if you were an officer class, you were the boss, no matter how young or inexperienced you might be, right. Was my complaint. Fortunately, none of us on our base. Bill Heinsohn was a little bit like that, in the sense that he had just been doing his 2 years in the Navy and was brought in at the last minute and was a little bit like that. But he was very junior. He was younger than any of us. So it never arose, really. But that was the sort of guy who 2 years later might have been made base leader, I would have thought, by someone like Johnny Green. And that would have been unfortunate, frankly. Not that Bill wasn't anything but a great member of the team.
So the root cause is the establishment, really?
I think a lot of it was this concept of it would never have happened in the States, I don't think. Certainly not in the Western States, but it would have happened in...
Talking of establishment, you had a visit from Prince Philip.
We did indeed, and I think it was January the 1st, actually, 1957. We had been warned that the ship would be coming in, probably.
The Britannia?
The Britannia didn't come in. He changed ship, I think. I think the Britannia probably stayed at Lochroy or something, or off Lochroy, somewhere like that. And he came in and arrived an hour early, which didn't help. but yes, that was very straightforward, really. And it didn't last long, 2 or 3 hours at the most, I suppose.
What was the point?
Just to visit the bases, I think. He was coming back from Australia. He was on his way back. But Parker, his assistant, came with him, and old man Priestley was there, and Johnny Green was there, and one or two others. And it was a very nice party.
You showed him round?
We showed him round, and Dennis tried to make him go out and take the dogs out and for a little run with the dog sledge. Unfortunately, the snow was much too soft right in the middle of the summer. It was a very hot day, I think. So he and Dennis had to push the sledge, which wasn't quite what was intended. But it worked. It worked very well. And it's a little bit awkward in the sense you didn't quite know how much. I remember myself hovering around it a little bit. He and Parker sort of wandered off on their own. And obviously they wanted to be on their own, but I wasn't sure if I should be around to know if they wanted anything else or not. So I sort of hovered in the sort of distance from them. I remember wondering whether I should be there or not. But that was the only thing, really. Otherwise, it went very well. We had a drink. And
had you painted the toilet in the true royal fashion?
No. But we had tidied up, obviously.
Perhaps again, in retrospect, do you think that was something to do with... Britain's claim to the Antarctic?
I'm sure it was. I mean, that stage, and there were still sort of occasional rumpuses with the Argentinians in particular. I think the Chileans were much more pleasant, but I think the Argentinians, which their bases were all run by their services, their army or some equivalent, not by amateurs like the British bases. So they were inclined to be more arrogant and anti-British. We made John Edwards, Wynne Edwards, was running a hydro survey in that 57 year, I think before the Duke came by or after, I don't know. But he had this 30-foot motorboat for doing this hydrographic survey, and he spent some weeks with us and spent some weeks at Lochroy. And then I persuaded him to take us around the island, hoping that I could get off at all the bits of rock that stuck out and see, at least collect a bit and see what they were. Didn't work very well because he was in too much of a hurry. But we did land at the Melker Islands, where the Argentines had a base on the north end of our island. And we got a very unpleasant welcome there. They didn't want to see us. That slightly surprised me, because I think at Hope Bay, where there was both bases, you know, they were getting on perfectly well. You know, there was none of this nonsense. But there was still that sort of legal thing where someone took in a notice saying you shouldn't be here, and that was replied by another note, protest note, you know. But that was going on. But on the whole, it was fairly affable. And they had to live there for the winter together, so there was not much point. But there had been problems, of course, with guns as well in the past.
Were they the best years of your life?
Were they the best years of my life? Probably. That first year in particular was really great fun. Yeah, I think so. It's difficult to think of another year that was as exciting and different and made me so fit. I mean, I've never been fitter, as you can imagine.
And was Caroline waiting for you when you got back?
She was. She's waiting for me in the car now, isn't
it? In which case, the better. There you go.
Probably should. Thanks a lot.